It's been nearly 200 years since French political scientist Alexis de Tocqueville traveled 7,000 miles across a very young United States. His book was called Democracy in America, and it described how all Americans had the potential to reach economic success no matter what their origins. But the American dream might feel a little outdated at this point. Political commentator and comedian John Fugelsang wanted to find out why. He has retraced de Tocqueville's journey, and what he discovered is the subject of a documentary that premieres tonight on PBS. It's called Dream On. John Fugelsang joins me now. Good morning.
Thank you, Celeste. What a pleasure to be here.
From what I understand from what you wrote about this documentary, you started looking into the American dream at a time when you had very good reason to think it was dead.
Yes, the narrative kind of dovetailed nicely. I was approached by two-time Oscar-nominated director Roger Weisberg about helping him with this film to retrace de Tocqueville's journey and doing in 2 or 3 months in a car what took de Tocqueville 9 months on horseback. At the time, I had been offered to do a primetime political comedy talk show for Al Gore's Current TV network. I'd been working on CNN, and I jumped over to Current and thought, well, this will run for years. And suddenly, in the midst of doing stories about hardworking Americans who show up one day and find their company's been sold to a foreign investor and you can apply to keep your job, maybe you'll be lucky and get to keep it, I found myself in much the same boat. So it seemed rather fortuitous that I was about to have all this free time to go on the road and make a road movie. And so it actually wound up having a nice personal edge to it. Although I will say that after our second day of shooting people, I realized I was never going to complain about a canceled TV show ever again.
Because their stories were, in some ways, shocking when you hear what people are living with and struggling through every single day in the United States. De Tocqueville, though, was coming from a very different, I mean, not only was he 200 years ago and when he was living, but he was an outsider. He was a foreigner. He was a Frenchman. And he also was trying to bring to his subject matter the detachment of a scientist. How did you approach that?
Well, de Tocqueville came to America sent on behalf of a French monarchy he despised to write a report on our prison system. And along the way, visiting our prisons, one of which was Sing Sing, which we filmed in for this documentary, along the way, traveling throughout the country, he did fall in love with this concept of upward mobility. In Democracy in America, he writes that originally in feudal Europe, the only way anyone ever rose in stature in society was if they joined the church and a poor person could become a bishop. But other than that, there was no social mobility. There was no ladder to be climbed. You had a caste system and you stayed in the station to which you were born. De Tocqueville marveled at this concept of a society where people could work hard, play by the rules, rise in society, and build a better life for their kids, knowing that their children would most likely have a higher standard of living. He said, no American is devoid of a yearning desire to rise. That's hardly unique to just Americans, but that became the backbone of what we now call the American dream. The concept of Roger's movie was to go on the road and visit all these same cities 200 years later and talk to Americans of all backgrounds about what the American dream was, what it is today, and what it still could be. We were in trailer parks. We were in rural obesity clinics in the Mississippi Delta. We were in prisons up north and down south, the worst homeless shelter in all of Detroit, the offices of billionaire Dan Gilbert in downtown Detroit. We went to colleges and spoke with experts, spoke with homeless vets, spoke with undocumented families. We were all across the country and did 200 interviews in 55 cities in 17 states.
Let's hear a little bit of a few of the interviews that you did. This is Tina McCoy. She lives in the Atlanta area. She works a fast food job for minimum wage to support both her daughter and herself. And she spends 4 hours commuting every day at a cost of $24 a day, but only earns $7.40 an hour.
What do you bring home when this is all done?
After the taxes, it's about $323 every 2 weeks.
Sure, every day and every night.
And I wanted to play one more comment from Tina McCoy here. Again, works a minimum wage job because this is when you were asking her about what the American dream means.
The American dream would be a living wage.
Is that dream alive?
No.
Think it will get better?
Well, I'm waiting on my day to come for it to get better.
What did you hear from most people, and how different were those answers according to their race, the city they were living in, and their standard of living?
Well, that's a pretty big question, and I'm glad you played Tina because she was one of the people that moved me the most on the shoot. There were two types of people. There were the ones who grew up believing in the American dream, believing in the American dream our parents and grandparents inherited. And then there were the folks who grew up knowing that that wasn't the case. And obviously, along color lines, it was rather stark, to be honest with you, as well as along economic lines. And low-income people of color and Caucasians had all grown up sort of thinking the American dream was something available to someone else. The surprising thing was how many folks who had grown up believing in it, who now recognize that for many, the middle class is the top of the bottom. And the American dream for so many has gone from prosperity to just scraping by. We spoke with multiple Caucasians in their 60s who never thought they'd be applying for SNAP benefits. But I didn't meet anyone who was cynical. I didn't meet anyone who didn't believe it. You know, the majority of Americans believe that the next generation is going to have a lower standard of living. But the majority of Americans also believe that their kids will have a higher standard of living. And that's one of the great paradoxes of the American dream. And while it may seem incongruous, it does speak to the optimism that still rests in the heart of Americans, despite what we've been through of 35 years of dramatically uneven income growth.
And yet the irony, watching this documentary, the irony really strikes you in the parallels with Alexis de Tocqueville's time. I want to play this comment from Jacob Hacker, who studies economics, healthcare reform, all those kind of things. He's the director of the Institution for Social and Policy Studies at Yale University.
To the extent that the wealthy are more influential and they're growing more distant from the rest of Americans, they're less and less concerned about the problems that middle-class Americans face. So to me, that's the fundamental issue. Are we losing that sense of broad-based civic togetherness that really sustained the American dream in the mid-20th century?
And this was ironic to me because this is the exact thing, this distance and this lack of empathy for people with lower incomes that caused a problem in France. I mean, it harkened back to a certain extent to let them eat cake.
Exactly right. I mean, at some point, your gated community won't have high enough walls to keep the rest of your country out. And even for myself, I was someone who thought myself very compassionate, full of empathy. My parents were both big social justice Catholics. My mom had been a nun who worked as a nurse with lepers in Malawi. My father had been a Franciscan brother who taught history and worshipped Gandhi and Jesus and Dr. King and Dorothy Day. And I had just finished doing a public affairs TV show where I focused heavily during the last presidential campaign on the issues of hardworking Americans. Empathy's not enough. Awareness is something that's always available to us. And for me, I wanted to get out of a TV studio and be a part of a project like this that actually went into the homes of people in America, the kind of folks that media types, even the well-intentioned ones, talk about with ever actually understanding. And Jacob Hacker was right. He was one of the many experts we talked to. And along the way, we interviewed everyone, Celeste, for this film, from Paul Krugman and Joseph Stiglitz to Mike Huckabee and Barbara Ehrenreich, Neil Ferguson up at Harvard. We thought we were going to be making a 10-hour documentary, and then along the way, PBS decided it was going to be a 90-minute feature. To their credit, they're putting tons of extra footage on the website for PBS. And I really fought with my director saying, you've got to keep Mike Huckabee and Paul Krugman in the film. But Roger was adamant about losing the celebrities and the experts and just telling more stories from real Americans. And I'm so glad it's a conflict I lost, because these are the stories that people need to hear. And I'm proud to be a part of a film that I can honestly say I wish most of our Congress and legislators would see, because it's one thing for struggling Americans to be colors on a chart and numbers on a page, but the actual stories are what really cut to the heart of our common humanity. And I think that for me, I could never give the subjects of this film what they gave me.
So let's hear one more voice. This is Carrie Dickinson, who works 35 hours a week at a laundromat in Rhode Island.
Right now, I'm lucky if I earn $1,000 a month.
Yeah, I don't even bring home $1,000 a month.
And what's your rent?
$1,100 a month.
It is a struggle day to day. It's very hard trying to figure out how you're going to do it, what bill is going to suffer just a little bit to make sure we have what we need.
So what did you come away with, having gone into this thinking, you know, maybe the American dream is dimmed? Where did you end up
that? Well, you know, this film made me more patriotic than ever, but not because of history or political ideology or symbols. It made me more patriotic because it deepened my love of the people and the land, and it deepened my love of the struggle of Americans. And again, the thing I took away with the most is that the American dream is the Russian dream, the Iranian dream, the Mexican dream, the South American dream, the European dream, the human dream. We all share that yearning desire to rise. And along the way, you know, Roger said, the film's getting kind of depressing. I'm like, oh, you think? Mass incarceration and obesity and food stamps? And he asked me if I could do a stand-up set riffing about some of the topics in the film. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't find a way to make it funny. So I really dug in, and I wound up writing a 90-minute, more of a solo show than a stand-up set, where I told the story of the making of the film and then worked all the funny into the narrative and crafted around my experience of losing a job. And we shot that in New York a year after we wrapped production, and they sort of Seinfelded it through the movie to bring some levity to it, which I did appreciate. So you sort of jump back and forth from this comedian riffing on these topics in a New York nightclub to then actually being in Alabama, being in Mississippi, being in prisons in Florida, and being in Sing Sing itself, where they have their college education program. It sort of highlights the fact that this is really a fish out of water movie for me, and it was something that it's changed me forever. And the fundamental question I walked away with, and we're very careful in the film, and Roger was very careful to try to avoid being too ideological politically, because we both believe that both parties deserve a lot of blame for this. And if government policies were able to help build a thriving middle class in the 1950s, President Eisenhower did things that worked, and we know they worked. And if we had the will, we could do them again. And both parties have contributed to this 35 years of dramatically uneven income growth. But at the end of the day, it comes back to aristocracy. And will the 0.01%, will the most powerful people of our society, they'll have a choice to make. Do they want to take a bigger piece of a shrinking pie? Or would they take a smaller piece of an expanding pie? Because we know we can help our fellow Americans. We just don't know if we have the will yet, and it may have to get a lot worse before it gets better.
Political commentator and comedian John Fugelsang, he wrote and stars in the new PBS documentary Dream On. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm really grateful. We had great experiences filming in Atlanta, and I'm really honored to join you on your show.
Dream On airs tonight at 10 on GPB TV. We're hanging out in the break room. It is time. Just a personal note this morning. If you are in the path of the hurricane, please do evacuate if they've told you to do so. And please bring your pets with you. As you've heard, it is not safe to leave your pets behind. The break room this morning, we've got H.B. Cho with us, a reporter for The Korean Daily. Will Kramer's a writer for The George Poll. Tamika DePriest, senior director for communications at Emory. And Hector Fernandez, professor of world languages and cultures at Georgia State University. Lots of things to talk about this whole week. We talked to both of the top candidates in the Senate race. We tracked the growth of militia groups. We remembered how fun it is to doodle in your kids' books. Now, let's sit back, let's relax, and let's think about what the heck happened. Time for the break room.
Did you guys see Game of Thrones last night?
Yes!
You saw Game of Thrones last night. You have something witty and intelligent to say about it. But that conversation is not for you. You can't join from the next table. That's pathetic.
Look at Wells Fargo. Really shocking, isn't it?
Look, a clown in the distance during the daytime is ball-retractingly terrifying.
On that note, let's talk about lunchtime. Did all of you guys, the four of you here, did all of you ever sit alone at lunch in school?
I did.
Anybody?
Occasionally.
Yeah, from time to time. Yeah. So this one high schooler named Natalie Hampton was bullied frequently at school. She got tired of feeling like an outcast, so she invented this app called Sit With Us, and it helps kids connect over lunch. And I wondered when I saw this, it's a nice effort, but what do we think? Do we think it could be effective? Would high school kids especially, or middle schoolers, actually use an app like this and go sit with someone?
You know, if you go to school lately, it's getting awfully difficult to tell who's sitting with a group and who's sitting by themselves, because they're all looking at their phones. I spent some time in high school recently because I was helping organize an event that was happening at the high school. And every time I go stop by the lunchtime, it's like awfully quiet for what I remember to be
our lunchtime was really loud.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, with that thought in mind, maybe the app will help. I certainly think that it has maybe more... may have more success than sort of parent-teacher pressure.
To do so.
So,
I mean, I'm just amazed that she was able to find something so constructive out of this traumatic experience. I mean, I whenever I was in high school, our lunches had, we had four different lunches. It was a very large school. And my lunch, I had two other friends. So if both of them were gone that day, I was sitting by myself, which was somewhat traumatic. So I'm really impressed that she took this experience and actually made it constructive to help other people.
That's a really good point. That's a good point. Hector, nothing to say about lunch?
No, I think what people don't realize is that cell phones enforce hierarchy. So this sort of application, I think it's wonderful. Because whether you see it or not, I mean, even if the kids are with the cell phones, mm-hmm. you know, the cliques are still being formed and people are still being excluded. So anything that brings people in, I think this is a wonderful application.
Okay, well, let's move on to something else that a lot of people actually watched on their cell phones. proposal videos. I mean, we've all seen at least one proposal videos, right? They go viral all the time. And there's also been a number of viral wedding videos. But recently there was a video that went viral that was both. Alfred Duncan proposed to his girlfriend, Cheryl Woodward, last Sunday. After she says yes, he then surprises her by saying the pre-planned wedding ceremony is ready to go for the exact same day. The two lovers got hitched hours after that proposal, and then they shared videos of that special day with the hashtag Forever Duncan.
I love you with my whole heart, baby.
So how romantic is this? I mean, a couple of you are making grimaces already, but I mean, would you want to, if you know you're going to marry someone, you said yes, right?
So stressful. I mean, what if she didn't like the colors? What if she didn't want her sister to have a prominent role? What if she didn't like the venue? I mean, that I can barely plan a date, nevertheless. an engagement and a wedding in the same day. So much stress. Why would you want to do that to yourself? I mean, it was cute. It was
maybe
romantic.
He was trying to nail her down.
I mean,
if he had to put a ring on it. Might as well do it.
Hot commodity.
That's right. You know what would have been the worst thing? If she'd said yes, assuming that she could get back out of it later.
Oh my God. What if she said no?
Well, you never know. It could have been the case. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, that's a whole thing. If you just sort of rush decisions, I think that's a lot of pressure. I don't think that's fair. Well, in my particular case, I just take a long time. You know, I think things through a lot. But, I mean, I don't think it's fair to the woman.
Yeah, but look how it turned out. I mean, so it sort of seems, we don't know, that he knew. He already knew that his probability was high. Because not only did he proposed, she accepted, and the marriage went on.
At the moment, it turned out right now.
Yeah, there are people who take 5 years, get married, and it doesn't work out.
Yeah. That's true. That's true.
Good point.
Raising my hand right here.
Well, how would you feel? I mean, what if he was just like, hey, guess what, Celeste?
That would not
We're
have
getting
worked
married
well.
Right now.
Yeah, that would not have worked well. But, yeah, you know, then there's the whole, and one of my producers point out the whole Harry Met Sally thing of, you know,
right.
When you realize you want to spend the rest of your life with someone, you want the rest of your life to start right now, right? That's romantic.
Huh. That's the movies.
Maybe we're just dead inside. Who knows?
Our break room gang is cynical and what did you say? Dead inside?
Dead okay. inside, yes.
our listener,
except me.
We have one live person.
Look, HBTO is so dead inside, he's not even commenting.
No, I was just thinking about how high are you going to keep setting the bars? You know, when it comes to like these
romantic
videos,
you mean?
Yeah, they're piling up, and when it's your turn to do it, then oh man, you have so many good examples that you need to kind of
One day you're gonna hit the peak, and just nothing will beat that peak video.
Right.
I mean,
that's actually true. If our listeners are out there are not dead inside, call us and tell us what you think. Would you accept your proposal and get married on the same day? Would you do it? 404-500-9457. You can call and leave a message or reach us on Twitter at OST Talk or on Facebook. Okay, one company that is not getting a lot of love right now is Wells Fargo. The banking giant is under a lot of scrutiny. It was found that they created millions of phony accounts in order to defraud customers. Thousands of employees have since been fired in the wake of that scandal. This week, Hillary Clinton weighed in.
It is outrageous that 8 years after a cowboy culture on Wall Street wrecked our economy, we are still seeing powerful bankers playing fast and loose with the law.
I hate how cowboys always get the brunt of the blame, but Clinton has vowed to hold the banking industry accountable if she gets elected. And here's my question. Look, banking was an important topic of conversation for the past two presidential elections. Is it still? Do we still, you know, is that still one of our priorities to reform our banking systems?
It's very important. I mean, regardless of how people are being distracted right now by other issues, the people who were responsible for the crisis back in 2008, they were never really brought to justice. And mm-hmm. the system was deregulated. It needs to be re-regulated so that something like what we had doesn't happen again, because it hasn't been implemented to full extent.
So, is it a high enough priority to you that would influence your
to me,
voting
yes.
decision?
To a lot of people distracted currently by somebody's orange hair, you know, it might not.
I don't think anybody's called his hair orange, right? Just his tanning.
Everybody.
Tamika, you're
so
about
big to...
to
hide all the secrets.
Tamika?
Yeah, it's an important topic. I mean, we're talking about, you know, in the words of Hillary Clinton, scamming customers, exploiting employees, ripping off taxpayers. Yeah, definitely. It has to remain a priority. And, you know, we're talking about the banking industry, but let us not forget the insurance industry, which is, you know, also have been
sort of... Are you talking about health insurance?
I'm thinking about the AIG situation. And so I think so. I think it's a high priority, and I do want to see the president get involved now rather than wait until there's a national negative impact on our economy from all these shenanigans, and then jump in.
HB?
I think when it comes to actually doing something about this legislatively and policy-wise, I feel like it is definitely going to the banking and how to deal with the you know, banking executives and kind of lawlessness of the very top in those big banks. I think that is part of it is going to influence my voting, but I feel like it might take a moderate Republican president to do something about it. If you see what happened with what has been attempted and pretty much kind of taken back.
That's an interesting point of view. And to a certain extent, there's certainly a cadre of Americans who care about this because Elizabeth Warren's popularity is sort of built on that. What do you think here, Will?
Well, you know, what we're seeing right now in both political parties is actually a pushback against capitalism, not capitalism specifically, but crony capitalism. You're seeing Donald Trump's rhetoric saying we need to deal with crony capitalism. And you have Elizabeth Warren on the other side of the spectrum saying the same thing. Of course, the routes to deal with the crony capitalists are different, but it's an issue that both sides of the spectrum are dealing with, and it's important to both sides. It's why you have these figures on the left and the right screaming about it. So I think that when you're dealing with something like Wells Fargo, it's a little bit complicated for just the general public to wrap its mind around. It has so many moving parts. That's why when you look at polls, the main issues are jobs and economy, not banking. It's jobs, economy, healthcare. Those are three big subjects. But yeah, I think that...
Although they might wrap banking up into economy.
Right. I think that banking's clearly a big issue, yeah. And it's something that will be addressed.
It is Friday. We are hanging out in the break room. You just heard Will Kramer of Georgia Poll. We also have HB Cho of Korean Daily, Hector Fernandez of Georgia State, and Tamika DePriest of Emory. We'll talk more about the recent outbreak of clown sightings in just a moment. This is On Second Thought.
Me here at last on the ground, you in midair.
Okay, I am actually pretty shocked that we're having to talk about clowns again. But it's gotten weirder since the last time we talked about it. If you're not familiar with the story, random clown sightings have happened all over the country, including quite a few in Georgia. And it's really making people nervous, maybe because of Stephen King's It.
Excuse me, sir. Do you have Prince Albert in a can? You do? Well, you better let the poor guy out. What? What? What?
Okay, so two women were just arrested in Detroit for dressing as clowns and chasing children, and there's a new high of tensions on the campus of Penn State. Hundreds of students went clown hunting there after there was a sighting. Streets were closed, and the campus was temporarily on lockdown because of clown riots. So here's my question. Like, it's almost like we can't dismiss it anymore, right? If you're wearing a clown costume, maybe you're immediately suspicious? I don't know. What do you think?
If you're wearing a clown costume and it's not Halloween, I first have to question you in general.
Right.
Because you're wearing a clown costume. But I quite frankly, I'm baffled by the entire thing. I don't know where this started. I don't know where, I mean, I have a genuine fear of clowns, but I don't know where this hysteria came from. I just don't understand.
It's what they're doing in these clown costumes.
Right, who decided, let's put on a clown costume and terrorize the general population?
That's
who had this idea?
As someone who grew up with Ronald McDonald and Bozo, yes, this is confusing.
There is an actual coulrophobia, is the fear of clowns. That's an actual thing. HB, what do you think? What is behind all of this?
I don't know. We haven't really seen any photos of things. So it might just be somebody having fun.
Well, you can see the arrest photos from these two women.
Well, right.
Yeah, in Michigan.
But you know, with Pence, with the college campus, they don't even think there are actually clowns.
Yeah,
they think these like 1,000 students.
Penn State is different. Penn State is just Happy Valley is really boring. So they gotta have something going on. You know, that's an exception.
So they just like 1,000 students went clown hunting, which is amazing. That's the power of social media, right there.
Right.
That's the power of social media.
Call my friends in China that run clothing factories and, hey, send over thousands of clown makeups and costumes for Halloween. They're going to sell.
Halloween's could be weird this year.
It could be.
Oh, I haven't thought about that.
Yeah.
That could be unfortunate.
It could.
For some people.
It could be. Okay. There is now a different online movement in a very different area of our lives. It's hoping to change the way that we identify vegan foods. A consumer accidentally bought vegan cheese recently, cheese that was made with coconuts instead of dairy. And he said, quote, cheese is not made with coconuts. Call it Gary or something. Don't call it cheese because it's not cheese, end quote. Shortly after that, a petition on change.org was created by a vegan and signed by vegans saying they actually totally support the idea of changing the name of vegan cheese to Gary. All right. So, okay, we may not change the name of vegan cheese to Gary, but does the consumer have a point? I mean, should vegan products be labeled more clearly?
Absolutely. As a lifelong vegetarian, I support it. Why? I'll give you an example. I love my brownies, right? If you go to a vegan store and you buy brownies, they have carob. And carob, all due respect, it doesn't cut it. I mean, do you think chocolate, you know, chocolate is you know, it shouldn't be changed, right? But still, vegans change it. So I think labels would make a good point.
Okay. Anybody else had the unfortunate mistake of buying something that ended up being vegan?
Not exactly, but I am very interested in eating healthy, and I have been to many different vegan cooking classes, cooking demos, and many times they would use fake, you know, meat, fake fish, fake whatever, reconstituted meat replacement made from soy, and they don't taste anything like the real thing.
Yeah.
And so there are many other ways that you don't have to be trick yourself into eating something else when you're really eating.
Oh, you're kind of saying if you're going to be vegan, just be vegan and eat vegetables. Don't eat something that's supposed to taste like tuna.
Yeah.
Well, if you're a vegan, you really don't, or a vegetarian for that matter, you don't really miss the taste of the meat. You know, the industry is just simplifying.
Well, then why do they have so many meatless products?
That's the industry. But you don't really miss the taste of any. I don't want chicken. You know, I actually like the soy. You know, the way it comes supposedly to look like chicken, but I don't care for chicken.
But what about the protein source? I thought some of these things that sort of give you a sense that they are meat but meatless were also designed to sort of help with the protein.
Nuts are full of protein.
Okay.
Yeah. But let's go back to the labeling thing. Do we need to label them more clearly so you don't accidentally buy meatless sausage?
For some people, absolutely.
I think clear labels go a long way against sort of false advertising. So, yes, give us clear labels.
Well, I mean, it kind of goes back to the whole butter versus margarine thing that America went through, like in the early 1900s. I know how silly that sounds, but there was an actual debate with laws passed over the marketing for margarine versus butter, because they were saying that margarine was butter when it really wasn't. And that's all I could. That's all I could think about this entire time was margarine and butter.
It'd be interesting to see if vegan products that are not prominently labeled as vegan sell better than the same thing that says Gary instead of cheese.
Oh, yeah, like what's the number of people that accidentally buy Gary? Right. Okay, so let's move on to something else that a lot of people are buying. Netflix and Marvel Studios have teamed up. There's a number of really successful shows that they've teamed up on. There's Daredevil, there's Jessica Jones. Last week, they added one more hero to that mix, Luke Cage.
You should be out there helping people.
You think I asked for any of this? I was put in some tank like an exotic fish. Came out with abilities. I just want to be left the hell alone.
Well, that would be a waste.
Okay, so this show debuted this past weekend, and the demand was so great. So many people were watching Luke Cage at the same time that they crashed Netflix's servers temporarily. Netflix is back on. But, A, who among you has watched the show so far?
I watched the first episode last night, actually.
Oh, God.
And?
It was good.
Yeah, I watched it good. Also. And nobody else?
I have to catch up on it, so I have not seen it.
I'm still in the middle of Jessica Jones, so I'm already acquainted with the guy. And I'll tell you one thing. The key reason people are watching his series is blaxploitation, for sure. I mean,
The
guy's a hunk, so they know what they're doing.
But that's very different. You have to be careful about that word blaxploitation, because it refers to a specific thing.
Regardless of the fact, the show is produced by African-Americans, right? It's all managed by African-Americans, which has nothing to do at all with the fact that they can't, you know, benefit in some, you know, mercenary way from the whole thing.
So I sort of had a different sense in thinking about the popularity of it. And mine was sort of connected to, you know, a black superhero as a sort of ultimate empowering fantasy escape, you know, during these sort of turbulent times of activism and protest.
I mean, because there's some people who said the one thing that we could use is an African-American male who's bulletproof at this point. HB, what do you think is the popularity of Luke Cage?
I actually have not seen even screenshot.
And nobody that you know is talking about it?
No.
It's
I need to catch up on Breaking Bad.
Well, you know, oh my God, you're really behind, HB.
You know, the character was introduced basically because the guy, you know, because Jessica Jones had sex with him, right?
Right.
So, I mean, at least in the part of Jessica Jones, mostly he's portrayed as a sex object. You know.
Okay, Hector, I'm going to have to stop you because you have to watch the show before you start saying this stuff. Blaxploitation is specifically about like stereotyped roles in movies that exploit black people. So you have to be careful with that, and also be careful about assuming he's a sex symbol before you watch the show there, Mr. Fernandez.
All right, time will go by and we'll see. And I grew up watching films with Jim Brown, so I know what I'm talking about. I mean, the fact that we're in 2000-something, 2100-something, you know, might change things a little bit, but they're doing it.
The year is 2016.
2016. Well, whatever.
Look, I lose track of time too. I feel like
that's fine. That's not the point. The point is, they're doing something with this show. They're really good at it. You know, they're really good at it, and the guy is gonna go big. I can feel it.
Tamika is literally biting her lip right now.
It's like
she's like, I'm not going to say what's inside my head right now.
I'm done.
But we would love to hear our listeners say what's inside your heads right now. Complaints to Hector Fernandez at complaints.com.
That's fine.
Or you can tweet us at OST Talk. It is Friday. We're hanging out in the break room with Georgia State Professor Hector Fernandez, Korean Daily reporter HB Cho, Georgia Poll writer Will Kramer, and Emory's Senior Director for Communications, Tamika DePriest. Okay, let's talk about something that maybe gets a little more unity. If you have binge-watched all 13 episodes of Luke Cage, maybe you're ready to start on something else, and they're bringing one very popular series of films back to the big screen.
Of course, you know all about Hogwarts.
Sorry, no.
No? Blimey, Harry, didn't you ever wonder where your mum and dad learned it all?
Learned what?
You're a wizard, Harry.
You're a wizard, Harry. IMAX theaters across the country will screen all 8 Harry Potter films next week. That means that they're going to retrofit some of those films to be in the IMAX format. And what do you think? Would you be ready to watch these films on the big screen again?
I've never seen them.
Oh, any of them?
God.
None. I haven't seen them. I'm a Southern Baptist pastor's son. Witchcraft. Come on, you guys. But I'm not kidding. I genuinely haven't seen them for that exact reason. I never read the book.
Wait. For that reason, because you're a pastor's son, you
haven't
watched?
I mean, in my household, it was witchcraft. And that's bad.
Oh, God. I thought it had something to do with state government.
No. No. Just witchcraft.
Would you watch it now?
I would absolutely watch it. Mostly because my friends seem to really like Harry Potter, and I would like to be able to have conversations with them.
Right,
about
so you know
Harry
what you're
Potter.
Talking about.
Right, so right. I don't just look at him and go, abracadabra.
If not Harry Potter, tell me what films you would actually, what film series would you actually go back into the movie theaters to watch?
Star Wars. Easy.
Okay, all
six? Oh, yeah.
Six?
Star Wars. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Matrix. I would love to see a film series with movies by David Lean, you know, because they're beautiful. I mean, if you have them in a huge, huge screen, they're just beautiful. They're gorgeous films.
Jurassic Park.
Oh, that's a good one.
That's a good one because those, you know, kind of belong on the big screen to really appreciate them. HBO?
Matrix?
All of them, though?
Really the first one, but...
My favorite as well.
Okay. Let me put that also out to our listeners. What film series would you go back into the movie theaters to watch again? I was assuming one of you would say Lord of the Rings, but, you know, we'll
see.
It's
another series I've never seen, too.
Oh, God.
I know. I need to get out of the house.
You are getting so much side eye at this table.
I am.
It's
culturally
too bad.
Isolated.
Yeah, it's too bad this is radio. And
does that show the state administration as like culturally isolated? Or?
This is a lot of shade in the OST Talk studio today. All right, let's move on. Atlanta has been named one of the 19 knowledge capitals of the world. That comes from the Brookings Institute. They issued a report that measured cities by economic output, innovative advances, and learning centers, among a few other things. Some other cities on the list, Dallas, Zurich, and Stockholm. You guys travel, right? You've been to some of these other cities. What do you think? Do you buy this? Is Atlanta an knowledge capital?
Atlanta's getting there, definitely. I mean, it has the film industry going there. It has video games going there. It has Tech, State, and Emory. Those are three large research institutions. That's a lot for a city like Atlanta.
Not to mention the CDC.
Pardon me?
Not to mention the CDC.
Well, the CDC, well, that's attached to Emory, so I consider it like an appendix.
And lots of corporate headquarters, right? And so I think when you throw that into the mix, and you just mentioned a few of the higher ed institutions.
Well, I just mentioned the research ones. That's
all. Yeah.
But you have, you know, really lots of them. If you add also the liberal arts institutions that are here as well. And so, you know, I've been in higher education now for 14 years. And so I can remember organizations like Arch. You know, the Metro Atlanta Chamber of Commerce has the Higher Education Council plus other, you know, groups connected to it that would be considered intellectual capital. So, yeah, absolutely.
I think it's finally getting the recognition that we kind of have deserved for a while. And I don't know what changed, but I think the number of industries that we can kind of safely point to Atlanta as one of the leading cities, like, you know, healthcare, IT, and a few other things. I think because of those, we are finally getting some recognition.
Yeah, I have several friends that work in economic development. Two of my very close friends, in fact, work within the economic development field for the governor. And they constantly have things to brag on for Atlanta, and they're constantly bringing new industry and new jobs to Atlanta. I mean, it's almost like once or twice a month, there's some new press release coming about a company moving to the Atlanta area. I think there's just Tory Burch just announced that there's an opening in Henry County. I mean, just constantly new industries coming here because of our innovation. And
we only have like a minute left, but what makes a knowledge capital? And I mean, a knowledge capital you'd think would be a place that's known for all the brains inside the city limits, right?
No, don't get me wrong. Atlanta is producing knowledge. It's not a matter of just service. It's a matter of actually producing something over here. And that is happening, or at least beginning to happen in Atlanta. know, so I don't think we're exactly there, but we're getting there. The things are going in a good direction. I mean, look at the Fortune 500 companies that are moving close to Georgia Tech and the research hub they created in Medtown.
And the startups, mm-hmm. And the support for startups and what they're bringing in terms of innovation, which has already been mentioned. So, I mean, I sort of agree. We're on our way.
Okay, we are out of time in the break room today. I want to say thank you to all of my guests. Hector Fernandez is professor of world languages and cultures at Georgia State University. H.B. Cho is a reporter for the Korean Daily. Will Kramer writes for the Georgia Poll. And Tamika DePriest is senior director for communications at Emory. That's our show for today and for the week. But let's put this question out to all of you out there. What makes a city known for its brains, for its intellect, and does Atlanta meet those requirements, do you think? You can call us, send us a message on Twitter at OST Talk, or find us on Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great weekend and stay safe.